Welcome to QUT Exec Insights, conversations about Australian business and the changing world. Brought to you by QUTX, professional and executive education for the real world. I'm your host, Kate Joiner. Today is another first for our series. I've stepped away from our usual lineup of distinguished QUT professors, and I'm talking to the next generation of QUT talent. So like many people, I was amazed at the news of the millions in prize money on offer with different esports leagues. There was a trend here that was worth exploring. And when I asked around QUT for someone to talk about this, I wasn't directed to a distinguished professor. I was directed to Michael Trotter, who is currently completing a PhD looking at performance in esports. But as well as this academic interest, he was successful in an entrepreneurial fashion, bringing esports to QUT as the co-founder of QUT Esports, which is Australia's first university esports program. Michael has a degree in psychology and is currently completing a PhD looking at performance in esports. He has a history in youth development and coaching and in outdoor education and snow skiing. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
So youth development and coaching and outdoor education. So I can see the link there between that and esports. Yeah, because your study looks at young people and how they engage in all sorts of activities, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Mm. So the study that we're conducting at the moment is looking at what kinds of positive youth development are occurring within youth that are partaking in esports tournaments.
Oh, I see. So it can have that sort of positive spin on it, where we think of people, kids playing video games as something negative, but it can in fact have a positive development impact.
I completely agree with that. I think that traditionally video gaming has had a really bad negative stereotype to it. I think we think of, you know, unattractive, nerdy, sweaty, you know, young men sitting in their mum's basements playing video games till all hours of the morning. And I think what we're beginning to see now is that that's changing. We're seeing more young people taking part in competitive video gaming, where they're forming teams and relying on their social skills and ability to communicate and showing leadership in order to overcome another team of players. But unlike sport, where this all happens on a field and it's all involved with a degree of physicality, we're seeing esports now is occurring in the digital space, where the computers ultimately act like the football field and players have to compete in that environment.
Compete in that environment. So this is us. I won't reveal my age, but let us just say your average baby boomer. So when we see this big prize money and it's for a thing called esports, and it seems to have just risen in public attention in the last year. So what is it and why is there so much prize money attached to it?
So esports is the competitive playing of video games. So it's very much structured in a similar way to what traditional sports is. So teams are pre-organized and they come together. Often at the elite level, they do so underneath an organization. So in much the same way as you'll have the Brisbane Lions, the Brisbane Broncos, as an organization that bring together players and have a pathway towards their elite level players. Organizations exist in the world for esports as well, where they recruit the highest level players they can, and they then compete against other organizations in a sports-like tournament structure. So, and with that, those teams are then competing in an organized tournament that is developed by the publisher of the game. So, and those publishers often put forward a certain amount of money as a prize pool. Some publishers put forward that money in its entirety. So when we look at games like Fortnite, that in their first season, they put forward $100 million in prize pool, where other games such as the Dota International, which I think might be the one you're referring to.
Oh, okay, yes.
Where a young Australian age 19.
That's why we saw it, because it was an Australian who won.
Yeah, I correct. See. So there's a young Australian who's 19 years old, has now won that tournament twice in a row as part of a broader team.
So he won 4.2, I think, in the first round and maybe a similar amount?
Yeah, it was slightly more in the second time around. I can't remember the exact statistic of the
first
one.
But serious money.
It was more than the most recent winning in 2019 was $4.62 million.
So that's up there with elite tennis, for example, in terms of prize pool money.
Yes, that's correct. So he is now winning. He has now won in the space of 2 years more than some of our more well-known athletes that are competing in traditional sport.
And imagine too, then we'll explore this later, the skills involved, but potentially if you were an elite esports player, you would have a longer career than maybe, you know, our elite tennis players, for example.
Well, there is a potential for that in the future, but at the moment the lifespan of an elite player in esports is relatively short.
Is that right? And why is that?
We still don't fully understand that, but I think it's because with new players that are rising that are competing at a really high level, appearing on the scene, they'll often overtake the places of other lower level players.
Churn.
It can be, yeah, it can be. And I suppose there are definitely players that sit on the very, very top of the rank that have been around for a long time that are really well known. And that's probably not that much different from the selection process for games like AFL, where some players may be drafted and may only last for maybe a season or two seasons.
I see. So this the companies that own, what was the game that you mentioned that I think I'm going to lose?
So League of Legends.
League of Legends. Right. All right. That's one I haven't heard at all. So someone owns the license for that game and they then own the tournament. Have I got that right?
Yeah. So this is where it starts to get a little bit tricky. So there is a very, there's a bit of a delicate interplay between organisations, players, and the actual game publishers themselves. So the game publishers own the rights to their individual game, and they will on some occasions be the ones to organise the tournaments that then organisations who are the ones that organise players will compete in. On other instances though, there are some publishers that are much more open with how their IP is used and will happily have third party groups come in and run the tournaments on their behalf.
I see. So I can imagine if you to recruit a team, like you use the analogy of the Brisbane Lions, so your team could be anyone internationally.
Correct.
That's right. So as an individual player, as an Australian, to get on that particular team, it would be hugely competitive. With that, have I got that right?
100%. Absolutely. Players are in fact sourced from all around the world for different organisations. And so, for example, there's a team called the Renegades, which is a primarily Australian team and has mostly Australian players in it, that is based out of the United States. So it's not uncommon at all to see teams selecting players from the entire global community, which does make it more tricky to kind of rise to the very top of that heap and to find a way into one of these teams. The other thing that is a real issue is the fact that there's no grassroots pathway that has been established into these various different esports teams. So the method of getting selected is a little bit more tricky. So unlike in NRL or in local sporting teams here in Brisbane, where you'll start in high school and you'll work your way up into state level and you slowly but surely feed your way into the elite level teams, that doesn't exist in esports. So the selection methods for players ranges and is varied based on the different teams and how they would like to select. Which makes life a little bit tricky for aspiring players and could potentially be part of the reason why there is a bit of a turnover in the lifespan of players.
So, I see, because it's such a large potential pool that you can be overtaken more quickly.
Correct. And the other thing is as well is we are yet to fully understand what determines the success of an esports competitor. We don't know how much psychology or fitness or game knowledge all plays a role in the level of expertise.
So this is in fact your research, Michael?
Yeah, correct. So what we're currently looking at, we've run a study that's been run over that has been distributed worldwide, and we've got players from a wide number of countries, and we've got about 1,500 participants, and we're looking at factors such as how physically fit they are, how much social support they're receiving in partaking in esports, and what their psychology is like. So how many performance psychology tools they have at their disposal, how well self-regulated they are.
So it could be there's a correlation between the things that make traditional physical athletes successful and those that make esports elite players successful as well.
Yeah, and that's what we're seeking to understand.
Mm. So we can hear the results of your research maybe at another podcast, Michael.
Yes.
But we've mentioned the business elements of esports. So, I mean, a prize pool of $100 million probably means that the industry is worth I don't know how many billions.
I think the industry at the moment is sitting over $1 billion US. And it's receiving at the moment, I think, about a 20% annual increase. So the growth of the esports industry is quite phenomenal.
So that's just the sports element to it. So the actual sale of games or participating in games is
would be much greater.
Much
than
greater than that.
Yeah, I don't have any specific figures on that, but the game publishers themselves would be making a lot more.
And is there a relationship between the two? So you probably this is my boomer brain, Michael, again. So those who own the rights to the games also probably run the have an interest in the tournaments as well. So it's an integrated industry.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. And I think if we look at, so we spoke a little earlier about the 19-year-old that won that really large proportion of money. So that particular tournament is quite interesting in the way that the prize pool is funded. So the tournament itself is owned by Valve, which is the publisher, and they contribute a little over, I think it's a little over $1 million towards the prize pool. However, the prize pool itself is valued at about just below $35 million. So then the question is, well, where does that money come from? And the answer is that a lot of it comes from within in-game sales. So Valve actually sells skins and in-game cosmetics as well as stickers and various other things in-game. And a proportion of the money that goes towards that those sales is then taken and put into the prize pool. I believe it's about 25%. So Valve themselves make an enormous amount of money off the generation of that prize pool and in-game sales. So in some respects, esports could be seen as part of the marketing tool for the broader sale of the game themselves, which is a little bit different from traditional sports.
I see. I'm beginning to see the shape of the industry here. It's all becoming more clear to me. So in preparing for the podcast, I was reading that universities are taking serious interest in esports, building facilities. So I read that the University of California, for example, had built, you know, some magnificent stadium dedicated to esports and were funding scholarships and so forth. So I guess that's another thing that thought, oh my goodness, this is definitely something to pay attention to. So, you know, to some of us, it seems like a really serious investment for us that thought that, yes, had the image of sweaty young men in a basement. But so what are we, why are the universities doing this and what's their sort of end game, do you think?
I think the universities are interested in esports because it's a new and emerging industry, and with this new industry, there are going to be lots of opportunities for research. So not only in the playing of the game, so from our perspective, you know, we're researching the psychology and the fitness elements of esports, but you've also got to look at things like, you know, the marketing element, the business element of the industry, the laws that are in and around playing. There's no body within Australia that represents the regulation of the industry, of the esports industry. There are a number of groups that are kind of positioning themselves towards that goal, but they haven't made it yet. So there are lots of different elements that need to be researched and need evidence to be put behind them. And so one of the opportunities that a university sees in this space is the opportunity to fulfill that need and to create lots of research. And there are lots of researchers who are interested in being on the forefront.
So if you create the phenomenon itself, you've got a ready-made study site, is it, for studying some of the phenomena of esports?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other two elements to the area that universities are quite interested in is in student attraction. So there are so many young people that are coming through who are highly interested in esports, and as of yet, like we mentioned earlier, there's not a lot of grassroots opportunities, and that extends not only into playing but also into getting into industry. So universities are hoping to position themselves as an environment where students can come and learn the practical skills behind running an esports tournament, managing an esports team, being a player within an organization, as well as all of the different technical elements that go on behind the scenes.
So I can see that. So it's an industry, and it's a sports management kind of approach, as well as actually playing. So was that your interest in bringing esports to QUT? So tell us that story. There's a little story of entrepreneurship that I like here. So tell us the story about how you brought it to our university.
Yeah, okay. So the story of how esports came to QUT is a bit of an interesting one, actually. So my co-founder, Dylan Polis, and I were at the time still in our undergrad of psychology, and we were talking about the fact that it was interesting that we found it so much easier to play video games and to learn every aspect of a video game than what it was necessarily to read our textbooks. I think that the quote was that, you know, it was easy to play 15 hours of video games and read 15 minutes of a textbook.
It's a depressing statistic there, Michael.
Yeah, no doubt. I think the thing that was interesting about that was, you know, why is it that I'm applying all of the same kind of research skills towards understanding the inner workings of a video game, and why am I so driven to do that? And yet I don't have necessarily the same drive towards my studies towards my psychology. And why is that? And we kind of came up with the idea, well, maybe video gaming, we're looking at it in the wrong way. Maybe there was an opportunity to actually harness the passion that young people have for video gaming in order to be able to help them further their careers. It was about the same time that we were having this conversation that we saw a lot of the information that was coming out of the University of California, Irvine, and they had just released and opened their new arenas on campus. And we saw this and we thought, wow, this is amazing. What they're doing is incredible. There's so many opportunities here for students. It's opening so many doors. And we were then surprised to find that nobody in Australia was doing this. So we actually contacted the University of California, Irvine to ask them, you know, what were they doing? How were they so successful? And if they had any tips for us. And they were kind enough to kind of give us a few pointers and a few directions in which we might go. And from there, we went and spoke to the Australian industry. So we reached out to the head of ESL Australia, who is Australia's largest esports independent organisation. So they run a lot of the tournaments that publishers, pay them to run. They gave us some tips and they gave us some opportunities to link our program in with them. And from there, we said, okay, we need a space on campus, and we went and knocked on a few doors and kind of scraped together all of the resources that we possibly could from anyone who would give them to us. And on the first day of open day, we opened the doors, and within 6 months, we had a 700 student strong community. And then we went and took a business case forward to the university and said, this is how we believe that the university will most prosper from the concept of esports on campus. And this is how we believe that it'll fund itself.
That sounds easy. I'm sure it wasn't. I think you might have glossed over maybe some of the barriers. I imagine the first response you get, Michael, honestly, was how is this sport? Is that right? Or
yeah, definitely. I think that's the first thing that we always get is computer gaming isn't a sport, and we get that quite frequently. And yes, we got that a little bit. I think one of the things which really helped us get over the line in the initial kind of part of our convincing of the university was the sheer enthusiasm that we had. Being a little naive, one of the first people we approached at QT was actually in the chancellery, and we just walked into their office. And we walked straight past the receptionist, and I think we must have done it with enough confidence that they thought we were supposed to be there.
For those of us who don't know university cultures, that's something you never do.
No.
It takes the naivety of youth to do that.
Yeah, I think we've learned that was a bit of a social faux pas, but we walked in and we sat down and we said, look, we have an idea. We've got a cunning idea. And David Fagan, who was in the chancellery at the time, was kind enough to hear us out. And so we sat down and we'd made a video, and so we showed it to him and explained what we wanted to do. And his comment was something along the lines of, look, I don't really understand esports, but you boys are very clearly very passionate about this. And so over time we continued to kind of build on the idea and continue to pitch to him and various others in the chancellery, and eventually got over the line and managed to drum up that support.
Good move. Well done.
Yeah, thanks. Mm.
So where are we physically located? Is it at Covent Grove?
No, actually here at Gardens Point.
Yeah, okay. So as much as I know. Yeah, I'm here also at Gardens Point.
Yeah, over at X-Block on the ground floor of X-Block, there is on the side, just beside Aromas Cafe, we've got the arena there that's got a bunch of high-end gaming machines, and it's a space that's been very specifically designed to meet the needs of video gamers on campus.
There is a stadium there, and I have not known about this. Yes, what does that say about me? Or if I asked all my academic colleagues, they probably wouldn't know either, but they will after this podcast, Michael. Mm. I'll make sure everybody knows. So I'd imagine at the University of California, Irvine, there's some very specific ways that you would design a space like that if you actually wanted to hold a tournament. if it was purpose-built, for example. Yeah,
definitely. So the way that the space here at QUT is designed is to meet two very distinct users of the space. So before we kick the program off, we actually did a whole bunch of user group testing, I suppose you'd call it. So we sat down and interviewed as many students as we could that played games on campus to identify, okay, so what are the different personas here? Who are our different users? And there were really two broad categories. So one was kind of the social user, the people who are interested in partaking in competitive video gaming for the purpose of meeting other students and forming social bonds. And then there were those who were much more interested in trying to climb the ranks and
who are playing the game of the game.
Correct. Right? Mm. So the space at QUT has been designed in a very particular way. So when you walk into the space, the very front of the room is much more open, has a slightly higher ceiling to enable a kind of a welcoming environment. And students that are in that space have got a little bit more space and have got a chair in the middle of the room where they can sit and talk and discuss what's happening in games or in tournaments and connect socially in that space. And that's where they form friendships and all of those things. And at the back of the room, the ceiling is much lower. And it's the design and the color scheme in that space is designed to be a bit more in and around helping people to focus. And so in that space, there's less talking and there's much more focus on the game itself and developing strategies. And also at the very back of the room, there's an interactive whiteboard where students can actually pull up replays and discuss strategies and tactics and they can run coaching sessions and teach and learn different skills.
Tell me the gender breakup of participants. I'm imagining it's mostly male. What?
Yeah, correct. Mm. Look, it's an issue which has been flagged time and time again in the esports space. There is definitely a trend towards more male participation than female participation. And in countries that have got more established esports systems, that difference is less. So in places like South Korea, which is almost kind of the mecca of esports, where they've got government bodies that are involved in regulating the esports scene and all of those things, the gender disparity is less than what it is in countries that are kind of less developed in that sense.
Less developed, so that it requires a bit of institutional support to get females to be able to participate in these amazing prize pools. So
yeah, I think it's I think it takes a wide range of different factors to be involved, and it's something that we're still trying to figure out how to solve. I think part of it is which games become super popular.
So do women less like the I'm hoping they less like the shoot 'em up kind of kill everything sort of games, or
I think it depends on the specific game. So I think Overwatch is a really great example of a game which is doing some really good things in moving towards having more equal gender participation. So one of the ways they've done that is they've got a variety of different characters that can be played in the game that are of both genders and of all different body types. And there's a great deal less sexualization in a game like that versus something like Counter-Strike, which is terrorists versus counter-terrorists and is very violent in nature. Both of those games are still first-person shooters to a degree, but there's just a difference in the way that they're approached. And I think there's one element of that story is how do the game publishers design their games, but it also comes down to how, as a community, do we operate. I think one of the real barriers is that at the moment a lot of video games are played online and in your room. And so what that means is that really you can kind of almost act however it is you want online, and there's almost no repercussions to that. By bringing esports into an environment like a university where players are all in the same room, social norms can much more easily be controlled. So things like toxicity and sexism and all of those kind of really negative behaviors that we tend to think of when we think video gaming can be much more easily stamped out in those environments. And I think that's going to be particularly important to start implementing for the young people who are coming through, even from the perspective of in high school, where we have a real opportunity to really set the base level of what is and what is not acceptable.
So that's kind of gets me onto my very final question, which is what we might see in the next 3 to 5 years in this space. So do we see price pools even ballooning even further and the development of more and different kinds of games? I mean, once those kind of price pools are huge attractors, I'd imagine. So, I mean, it caught my baby boomer attention. It would catch other parents' attention, and suddenly, you know, we have more participation. It's something that I can foresee. What do you see?
Yeah, I think that there are definitely going to be games such as the Dota International where those prize pools are just going to keep growing. I would think that those numbers are just going to keep getting bigger and bigger every year. I think a lot of it is also going to depend on what kind of technology exists. So because esports is a digitally mediated competition, what we're going to see as far as technology goes is that things like VR at the moment aren't necessarily as entertaining or as accessible to especially young people. The cost of owning a VR headset and being able to partake in those games is much higher and much more difficult versus something like a laptop, which you can play all kinds of esports games on. And so I think as we see that technology develop, I think we'll see the the opportunities for different ways in which esports games can develop change a lot. And in fact, some of those, especially VR games, may even end up having a more physical kind of element to them. We may see them start to move closer and closer towards traditional sports in that area.
Amazing. So watch this space. Maybe we'll reconvene in a little while, Michael, and we can see where it's all gone. But congratulations on bringing esports to QUT, the first university esports program. And thank you for your contribution to QUT Exec Insights.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of QUT Exec Insights, brought to you by QUTX, Executive Education for the Real World. You can comment on the podcast or make suggestions for future guests at execinsights@qut.edu.au. We would love to hear from you. If you would like more information about professional development for yourself or your team, please search QUTX, that's QUTEX, and you will find our full range of programs. I'm your host, Kate Joyner, with sound recording and editing by Lance Scaife Elliott. See you next time.